Well, so it's a great, can you all hear me okay? Yeah. It's a great pleasure to be here. Is there a pointer? Is it this? Yeah, cool. Yeah. Yeah. So in coming, I was here at the last meeting of this, and I talked about electronic spectroscopy and multiple quantum coherences. And at the time, I was just super excited about the fact that we had an entirely femtosecond pulse shaper, automated, controlled, multiple quantum, two-dimensional femtosecond spectrometer to look at multiple quantum coherences. Today I'm going to talk about the same thing, except that it's going to be terahertz frequency coherences, including terahertz frequency multiple quantum coherences. So just to, however, I'll introduce the topic in a similar way, because once again, it's based on the same notion that we'll have multiple fields interacting with the sample to do coherent spectroscopy and coherent control. In this case, in the optical case, we had this pulse shaper based approach. And one of the cool things is that it's directly compatible with some of the methods that have been discussed extensively. And I'll just mention that we've started to do some of that in the optical regime. But first, let me just introduce multiple quantum spectroscopy. People you've seen some 2D spectroscopy, two-dimensional spectroscopy presented already, and certainly plenty of nonlinear spectroscopy. And inherent in some of the things that have been presented already are some multiple quantum coherences, but I just want to be explicit about it. So in one quantum measurements, typically a three-field chi-3 nonlinear measurement, one-dimensional or two-dimensional, it'll look something like this. The first field is coming in and making a coherence. And the second field is making a population. And the third field is generating a new coherence. It might be rephasing, and an echo would come, or it could be non-rephasing. And that will be the signal that is detected. In a 2D measurement, the full signal field is detected, and it's detected as a function of this delay. So there are two time coordinates in principle, and both could be Fourier transformed. In practice, in optical case, this is detected in the frequency domain. In the terahertz case, of course, this would all be detected in the time domain. In a two quantum measurement, though, the difference is the first field does the same thing. It's going to make a coherence, but the second field now is going to make a two quantum coherence. So in terms of wave functions, now we have a coherent superposition of 0, 1, and 2 after the second field, which means that there is a 0 to 2 coherence. It might be at about twice the frequency of the first one. It might be different. It's at the sum, the total frequency from 0 to 2. And then the third field projects back down to a new single quantum coherence that radiates the signal. And typically, the data would be collected in this case as the field is detected, but it's as a function of this delay, so you directly see the two quantum oscillations, even though the two quantum coherence itself normally does not produce signal, because often this is not the 0 to 2 transition is not dipole allowed. And the major motivation for doing this kind of work, especially in electronic spectroscopy, is because the two quantum coherences are only there if there are correlations among the different excitations involved. So this is all based on original NMR work, where you have dipolar coupling between spins that gives rise to two quantum coherences because they interact. In the case of excitons, then you have Coulomb coupling between the constituents. You have local field interactions and so forth. So at that time, I presented some data just from rubidium atoms. This is local field coupling them, and it's a two quantum measurement, so one axis is twice the frequency of the other, where again, two quanta have been put in. You've got a two omega oscillation, basically. And then the field that is detected is after the third field comes down, goes back to a one quantum coherence. That's what radiates, and you see the signal. Okay. And this is extendable. So we went up to tri-excitons. We looked at then now you have three fields coming in, single, double, triple quantum coherence, oscillations at roughly 3 omega. That doesn't make the signal that we look at, but two more fields project back down to a single quantum coherence, and that's what's finally detected, and there's the signal. So here's the three quantum axis and the detection axis, and again, there's signal there, very strong signal from tri-excitons. These are in gallium arsenide quantum wells. Well, so just a little summary of some progress since then. What we determined at that time, a terrific student, Duffy Turner, did this work, showed that really, in at least in gallium arsenide quantum wells, there was no significant further, four quantum or higher coherence. And what that said to us is that you have correlations among three excitons, significant in number, but not beyond that, at least under these conditions. But then we have since then looked at exciton polaritons in microcavities, and I'll just mention that there we do see four quantum coherences. That's because now you've got this field that's coupling the excitons. So you have coupling through the field. It's essentially what normally would be called local field, except it's really not so local field because the field is now trapped in the cavity, and so it really effectively couples the different exciton excitations. They don't even need to be on the same quantum well. They just need to be there in the cavity. The point is it's now possible to go to even higher order. So you can see four quantum, and I'm hopeful that we'll go higher still. And we've done a little bit of coherence control in these systems. This is directly exploiting something that Jan Silberberg demonstrated quite a while ago, which is that you could have multi-photon transitions optimized not with just an ordinary pulse, but by a phase window that would lead to a more effective superposition of the two photon transitions based on the first field being to the red or to the blue of an intermediate resonance. Well, so, and there have been other kinds of use of shape pulses, shape waveforms, of course, in 2D spectroscopy. Here, though, we wanted to do this to optimize the two quantum signals because it's based on a two photon transition. And it's very clear, so this is again in gallium arsenide, by either using a regular pulses or with the phase window, very, very different signals. Here's one two quantum signal. Here's another from a different exciton of nearby energy. The point is that by exploiting this very simple kind of phase control, it's easy to get strong enhancement of desired signals at the two quantum level. And of course, this could be extendable as well. And I just want to mention, we've collaborated with the group of Alanis Borodrusik to do some quantum process tomography work. We've just done the first demonstration of it for us, and this is using these Jagger nanotubes. They're huge manifolds, exciton manifolds, on the outside and inside walls. And basically, their protocol told us, well, let's do this as a frequency resolved set of measurements. We could determine the full density matrix, not most effectively by using just a broadband, very short pulse, but by using longer pulses that were centered on either the inner or outer wall exciton transition, and then using the various combinations of those to elaborate all of the density matrix terms. And I won't go into the details of it except to show a couple of results. The most interesting, really, is that if we excite the outer and inner wall, what we see is transfer of excitons from the outer to the inner wall. It revealed in a very direct way that we get exciton transfer. There's coupling between the two manifolds, and that's observable in the off-diagonal term as well. Okay, so now I'm going to start my talk, so you can start the clock. So the work I'm going to discuss is all by just a terrific postdoc named Charlie Fleischer. He's going to go, he's going to start a faculty position in Tel Aviv in the fall. And he really was the architect of this work because he had done his graduate work doing optical alignment of molecules in the gas phase. Those of you who know me know I don't do any gas phase spectroscopy, so I hardly know about how any of this works, but Charlie does, and he's just done some wonderful things. So with optical pulses, then the optical pulse will drive the molecular polarizability anisotropy and can align molecules. But the Terahertz pulse can grab dipoles, so now it knows the head from the tail in a polar molecule, and you can get orientation as well as alignment. So I should say, before I go on, though, I feel like I really shouldn't talk about Terahertz spectroscopy or nonlinear Terahertz spectroscopy without giving a shout out to the UCSB Terahertz FEL that is here. I don't know if Mark Sherwin is here, but hi. So you should see him and get a tour and all of that. So here's just one example. I could give lots of them, of some of the work, but this is maybe the most relevant to the topic of this meeting, some work out of Mark's group. This is from 2005 already. But just a bunch of interesting work that I think folks here would find quite fascinating. One more comment about prior work. I'm going to talk about Terahertz driving of molecular rotations. Actually, there's been a suggestion of, and even a demonstration, an experimental demonstration along with the calculation of using rho vibrational states essentially as qubits. I don't think the idea here, nor is it certainly not in my talk either, is to use these as a practical means for computation, but there is a very interesting test bed here, and so what I'm going to talk about is not going to look like this. This is involving different electronic states accessible through optical transitions. I'm down at terahertz frequencies, all in the ground electronic state, all in the ground vibrational state. But the point is there's a whole manifold of rotational states there with many, many transitions, many coherences. So what I will demonstrate are a couple of very facile ways to control very large numbers of coherences to make them superpose or interfere in desired ways. And so there's a very rich testbed for coherent control. So just a few words of how we make the terahertz field. So it became possible a few years back to be able to have good enough terahertz field strengths on a tabletop to do routine nonlinear spectroscopy. And by routine, I mean to the point where most materials will show nonlinear responses when irradiated by terahertz fields on the order of, say, 100 kilovolts per centimeter up to maybe a few megavolts per centimeter. And so basically it's based on what really is phonon polariton generation. Optical pulses, femtosecond pulses, are coming into a crystal of lithium niobate and exciting it through stimulated Raman scattering, driving the lattice vibrational mode, which is also strongly polar. And those coherent dipole oscillations radiate. And so the excitation that's produced is not purely a lattice vibration. It's a phonon polariton mode, and it propagates. And it reaches the edge of the crystal. It can couple out, and that's how we get strong fields. So I won't show all these movies. I'll just show one, two. There's one where a line of light was used, and now you can see these wave-like responses. This is a 3 by 6 millimeter crystal. This is very macroscopic, right? And that's the terahertz field that's propagating. And there are all sorts of interesting possibilities, but the one that matters most for our purpose is this. We can come and just build it up bigger and bigger as it goes with additional light, and by the time it reaches the end, it can have many microjoules of energy. Now some people are pushing a millijoule of energy in a single cycle terahertz pulse. So this is a schematic illustration of how it's actually done. It's a bulk lithium niobate crystal. The wave, the terahertz wave, has a little bit of a forward component, so it's cut to couple it out. This geometry was demonstrated by Janusz Hebling, and he joined with us for a couple of years, and we got together to make these substantial energy pulses, and then it just made it very easy to do nonlinear spectroscopy. This is the prism, the lithium niobate piece. This is so you typically get a single cycle, roughly single cycle of terahertz. The bandwidth covers a couple of terahertz. Okay, we're not restricted to single cycles. In lots of ways, we can shape the terahertz output. What I'll show you today is mainly due with just single cycle pulses or pairs of them. But it's quite straightforward to make shaped terahertz waveforms. Okay. And a bunch of nonlinear spectroscopy has been done at this point in gases and liquids and solids, all with a different types of degrees of freedom driven nonlinearly, and some quite nonlinear responses, including terahertz driven phase transitions. All right. So let me just talk a little bit about molecular orientation. All sorts of reasons to want to do it, right? Because now you don't have the whole isotropic collection of molecules. You can induce some degree of orientation and in various ways do spectroscopy, high harmonic generation, other study and applications of molecular orientation. So that's one of the motivations. All right. So, of course, the terahertz field can break the inversion symmetry and orient. And so in the optical pulse, you have a view of action on the polarizability. And in the terahertz case, again, you're acting on the dipole. So the result is here you've got a line, you've got alignment here, you have orientation. The heads from the tails are distinguished. Okay, and these can be described in a very straightforward way. And of course, what we're really doing is driving resonant orientational molecular rotational transitions. That spectral bandwidth of the terahertz pulse that I showed you overlaps lots of the rotational transitions for a moderate to small size molecule, and most of the results I'll show are for OCS, but water and other small molecules are easy to drive as well. And so, of course, the field will classically just set these in motion, but obviously the quantum states are crucial. So here's what happens if we just look. We come in with a terahertz pulse, and with these revivals that are very well known are what we see. And this is from OCS. So a pulse came in, and you've got many different rotational coherences, and they're all multiples of the same frequency, depending on the J state that the molecule started in, 1, 2, 3, up to about 40. Well, you have multiples of the same fundamental rotational frequency, and what that means is there'll be an initial orientation, and then they'll all go out of phase, but because they're multiples, they'll all come back into phase again. And then there'll be and each time that happens, suddenly you have a bunch of oriented dipoles, and there's a burst of radiation that comes out. This is the free induction decay. And there's another burst, and there's another burst, and so forth. And that's well known. Okay, and the quantum revivals, so the whole time-dependent wave function is periodic with the period of this revival time, which is just given by the rotational constant of the molecule. I should say, because the pulses are reasonably strong, even in non-polar molecules, we can actually do with Peretz pulses what's been done for a long time with optical pulses. We can act directly on the polarizabilities and produce alignment, and that's what's done here. This is dry air, so these are signals coming from nitrogen and oxygen molecules, and if you Fourier transform them, you can see all the transitions, the rotational Raman-allowed transitions. It's a delta J equals 2 transition, and you can see all the lines that have been driven by the Terahertz fields. But we're interested in interactions with polar molecules. So I showed you before the result of one interaction where you know the field comes in and it drives these coherences. That's the result of a single field interaction. The next field interaction will drive two quantum coherences. So now I'm starting in J, J plus 1, J plus 2, a coherent superposition of three states. Of course, the frequencies involved are different depending on what that initial J state is, and there are lots and lots of J states that are occupied initially thermally. So, the one photon interaction, the first field interaction produces the free induction decay, and in density matrix terms, all of these become non-zero. The second interaction, measurable by birefringence, is producing these two quantum coherences, and it also changes the populations, right? You essentially have population change with the second field interaction from J to J plus 1. Right? Now we can extend that and really control the sequence of field interactions by just using two coherent pulses that are separated in time instead of the signal that I've shown you, which is two field interactions coming from just one big pulse. Right? These two fields are coherent, so of course it's simple to do, but this is the fully coherent two-pulse driving field. And it turns out that if you do that, so what I've shown here is a composite of two data sets, really. This is for if I bring in just one pulse and let there be two field interactions, you can see the signal from it, and it's really little on this scale, and you'll see why shortly. And this is just the same birefringence signal. These are the two quantum coherences that I showed you before. This is the population that's been produced. If I come in with a second pulse only, not two pulses, but just bring another pulse in at this time, I'll see the same thing. Of course, it's just shifted in time a little bit. But if I have both pulses present at the same time, look what happens. The two quantum coherences are huge compared to these. So in other words, by having a time delay between the two field interactions, I drive the two quantum coherences much more effectively than if the two fields operate at the same time. And what's happening is, well, let me just define the term here first. This commensurate two-pulse revival occurs at a well-defined time, and of course it keeps going. After this is just the same revival time after the pulses. And what's happening is if you delay that second pulse by a different amount, this is just a bunch of separate sweeps. So here's one sweep where the second pulse came in here, and this is the signal, and here's the next signal. In another completely different experiment, the second pulse was delayed this amount, and now here's the signal, and here's the signal. And the simple point here is that the delay that's incurred here is half the additional delay here, and that's because it's a two quantum coherence, so the phase is evolving twice as fast, right? So these are the associated pulse delays and signals. And these are delays of picoseconds between the pulses. And these are increments of where that two quantum coherence first appears. So what's happening? Well, basically we have our two coherences, the one quantum coherences and the two quantum coherences that we're going to generate from them. But to optimize that, the timing matters, right? So if we time the delay properly, we can make it so that the two quantum coherence, the phase, will become J independent. And what that means is for any initial J, for every one of these one quantum coherences that we've generated, we can then project up to a two quantum coherence, and the two quantum coherence that results from every one of them, all those two quantum coherences, will be in phase at a certain time delay where that big signal appears. That doesn't happen if we just come in with two fields at the same time. You get some signal, but it's very poor because most of the interference is destructive rather than constructive. And so one way to think about that is you say, well, physically what's happening, even classically, at least for the zero time delay, you can kind of see what's killing this, which is, you know, the first field comes in and the heads that are mostly up here are going to be driven in this direction, right? But the heads that are down here, they're going to be driven up toward the equator. And what that means is, in terms of alignment, I have counter, these two things are working at cross purposes. If instead I wait a while, this I can't really describe properly classically, I can instead avoid the strong destructive interference, right? And that's what's happening. That's why there's so little signal if I overlap in time the two field interactions, and so much enhancement if I delay them instead. Okay. This, by the way, is a full two-dimensional terahertz measurement. That is, we scanned the delay time between the first two fields, and we measured. We didn't measure it by using a third terahertz field to project down to a single quantum coherence and seeing the outcome. We didn't need to, because in this case, the two quantum coherence can make signal directly. Not because it's allowed, it's not emitting terahertz light, but because it shows up as birefringence in an optical probe measurement. So we don't need to wait for the other two fields. But the point is that that's a full measurement of the time-dependent two quantum coherence. So the first time is the time interval between the pulses, and the second is the time-dependent two quantum coherence that results. Okay. Well, since this can be modeled reasonably well, you know, it's a little bit instructive to actually watch these things. Maybe I should just let it alone for a second. Yeah, you can see how the one quantum coherence first develops, because it only needs one field interaction to do that. And now the second field is going to come, and now you'll see both population change and the two quantum coherences grow in. You can see also distinct patterns in the one quantum coherences and also in the populations, right? To do this, you know, population is being shifted from alternate states which are decreased in population and others that are increased. And of course, all this depends on the delays between the pulses. Okay. This is just a simulation. The bottom is a simulation of the signal. We've seen higher order interactions, third and fourth order. This is a simulation, so it's just meant to look pretty, but it's just to indicate some of the things that are coming to look at regular echoes and so forth. So again, we've seen these sorts of signal components. We haven't done it extensively enough yet, but it's clearly on the way. But now I just want to cover one. How am I doing on time? Oh, perfect. Okay. So what I want to do is cover one more topic. I want to go back to one terahertz pulse and look at its multiple field interactions with the sample. So first, notice, of course, I've shown you a couple of things. One is a first field interaction that makes a free induction decay. So you see an initial terahertz burst when everything is lined up. All these coherences go out of phase. They come back in, and there's a revival, another terahertz burst, and so on. Meanwhile, a second field interaction produces population, and that's what this steady state or gradually decaying signal is. And you can see that it decays with, depending on the pressure of the gas, it decays with some decay time. The two quantum coherence, also its decay can be measured. They're not the same. And it's interesting to think about what's happening in a little more detail. You know, we're changing J. We're not changing M in these measurements. So what's really happening is, in terms of population, you're creating a non-thermal rotational distribution where, you know, if I start from zero, the lowest rotational state, I only go to 1, 0. I don't go to 1, 1 or 1, -1, right? So I've got a disparity in the subpopulations of the J levels that's not thermal, right? Where this one is overpopulated relative to the others. Similarly, going from 1 to 2, these become populated, these do not, and the same thing continues all the way up. Okay. One way to think of that is, if my field is here and I've got a molecule that happens to be oriented in a perpendicular plane, I make rotation. If the molecule, but of course, there's no law about that. So I can have all kinds of directions of the molecule initially, and I'll drive orientation along the polarization direction with my field, but I won't change the plane in which the molecule lies. And that's what's happening. Okay, so I'm going from a sort of three-dimensional distribution toward a two-dimensional one. Okay, now I want to just think a little bit about that population a little harder. So you can measure pretty straightforwardly. We can purge the cell, the gas cell with the OCS. Now there's nothing in it. We measure the Terex field that goes through, and then we measure it again with the gas in it, and of course not as much goes through, so some energy was imparted is the point. And then we can measure the FID, how much came out there, right? And integrate over the square of the field. And by doing that, we can say, well, how much of the energy that we originally put in came out over here? Normally, that's a negligible amount, right? This is a free induction decay. So you think of it, it's a one quantum coherence. And you don't go to the next order perturbatively and say, well, how much energy you count? But of course, you can do it. And since in this case, it's a fairly strong field, it's significant, right? So in this particular case, it's about 3% of the energy that came out. Well, that's interesting. Now let's go back and look at our population. Where did that energy come from anyway, right? It came from the rotations, right? So let's look carefully at the decay. This is just with different pressures. And if you look closely, you can see that something is funny that isn't quite the same as a simple exponential decay. And now let's look more closely. There it is. There's a sort of glitch. There's a jump downward. That happened because here's my population, and suddenly there was this release of a burst of terahertz of energy that took away a few percent of the energy. The population just went down, right? And you can measure it because it's not that small. Right? Now this is easy to simulate, and it's simulatable properly by introducing this additional term into the Hamiltonian. And what this is showing is that, you know, this is oscillations of the macroscopic dipole. Now, this is a topic that came up quite a number of years ago about how to properly describe essentially super radiance and similar effects. So there was a lot of work by Marlon Scully and a handful of other people to work on how this should be properly described, right? Now, of course, we're not doing super radiance, right? That is, that terahertz burst of emission is not building up from noise. So it's completely controlled. It's a coherently driven response, but it has the same effect because we're seeing it at second order where it's depleting population. It's taking measurable amounts of energy away from the system, and that's the important point. Right? But that's a nice thing for two reasons. One is we can see it. It's often quite difficult to measure cleanly that effect because when you look at just the free induction decay, and if you even do a measurement of population decay at the same time, which is rare enough, well, you know, they'll both decay exponentially if it's just a single coherence involved and so forth. Here, there's such a dramatic and simple to understand time dependence that this temporal signature just tells the tale, right? You know, the terahertz pulse, the terahertz FID is coming out as a burst, and the population is doing this, right? You know, go figure, right? It's not very complicated to understand basically what must be happening. So there it is. Of course, at the first one of these, nothing happens because the two quantum coherence comes at twice the revival time. So this is becoming, there's no terahertz burst here, but there is one here. So this is just a close-up of the first one. That there's no jump in the, no jog in the population, but here there is, just as I showed. And this continues, of course. Okay, oh, something bad happened. Well, you get the idea, though, of course, there's less population here, and because of further decay, there's a smaller jog here. But actually, you know, neglecting the decay of total population, you just get the same jog each time. Right? It's not due to propagation. That is, that could happen if in an even stronger field limit, but it's really just due to the fact that you've got reorientation of all of these coherences producing emission that brings energy away, and all these things. Messed up a little bit. We can do this as a function of pressure. Now, actually, we really should be looking at the coherent emission strength as a function of pressure. It gets bigger, of course. There are more molecules leading to the emission. I'm quite sure, but we haven't seen this directly, that the amount of energy would go like n squared. This is not it. Of course, we're just measuring birefringence, so it's a relative amount of change. Right? Okay, so this coherently driven super-duper radiance is just the last effect that I wanted to describe. And the reason that, perfect, okay. And so I just wanted to bring it out because I think it brings to the forefront a kind of light-matter interaction that's been extensively studied, but maybe not in such a simple and direct way where it's just easy to observe and also easy to control. So some of the next steps that we're taking are extending our coherent control measurements. We're bringing in more than two pulses. One reason is, by bringing in three fields, we're just going to do regular 2D spectroscopy, one quantum spectroscopy. And of course, the off-diagonal peaks in the spectrum tell you about coupling between the different levels involved. And I believe we'll be able to look at state-to-state couplings between different J states in an extremely facile way. This was studied extensively, you know, in the somewhere between recent and ancient history of physical chemistry in molecular beams at low temperature. A lot was learned, but those measurements were restricted to molecular beams at very low temperature, and I think we'll be able to do this sort of measurement in a flame, for example. But also, we should be able to exert some coherent control, further control over these two quantum coherences and higher order coherences that I've demonstrated, and also even over the population. Right? Okay. Well, I think I mentioned why it hasn't been easy to observe this before. One final thing, it won't be long, is one of the interesting possibilities is to use oriented molecules to do high harmonic generation from them in related forms of spectroscopy. Well, I'm here to report that we have already done that. We've succeeded in it. As long as high can be defined as 2. So we've seen second harmonic, and of course what's happening is you're breaking the symmetry, right, with the orientation of the molecules. And so, and this has been demonstrated before in the optical regime with combinations of fundamental and second harmonic generation also can break the symmetry, right? But it's very easy with Terrence pulses, and some of the unwanted nonlinear effects that can emerge there are easy to avoid in the case of Terrence. Well, okay, so I'll just show you some data. It's pretty easy to see what happens. Come on. There it is. So there, for example, is data. And this is actually the best way to look at the single quantum coherences. So these are spikes coming each time you've got orientation. There's a terahertz burst being emitted, but there's also a peak in the second harmonic generation. Very, very easy to detect with good sensitivity. Right? So I think that's really how we'll do things like the 2D spectroscopy that I just described. That will be what we detect rather than actually detecting the emitted terahertz field. Okay. I think that's it. This is just some other molecules in which we see those signals. But just to summarize, I've talked a little bit about just the prospects for nonlinear terahertz spectroscopy generally, but really about molecular rotational control, how these very large numbers of rotational coherences can still be tamed and controlled in a pretty facile way. And I think there are interesting extensions of this. And I've talked a little bit about what becomes enabled through some of this, and I just ended with this topic of a kind of something related closely to super radiance. Thank you. Oh, it's small. So far, it's small.
Isn't is if you're using a Piver tube, if you have a large pulse area, mm-hmm. then you're going to stimulate down. And so doesn't that make sense in that way? I mean, if you're
absolutely
so that step you see is a direct, isn't that just the direct measurement of the integrated whatever your pulse area is?
Effectively, yes. And that, in a sense, it's what I showed at the very beginning when I said let's integrate over E squared.
Right. So
it's exactly that. Sure.
So if you calculate your pulse area, then
yeah,
and
it's
then
conserving energy.
And then compared to that dip, it should be
absolutely
exactly that.
Done.
Okay.
So this is the thing. It's absolutely completely sensible, right?
Right. But people must see that in NMR too. Is it just because, I mean, you must see it. It's
well,
just, they're actually using,
the only difference is, you know.
See, because the difference is key to, is when they do their pulses, it's not up and a little bit down, it's up and all the way
of
down.
Of course.
Okay.
I think the bigger difference in a practice.
So, I mean, it's been seen in NMR. I mean,
pardon me?
It's seen in NMR.
You know, it surely should be seeable in NMR.
Yeah.
The only reason it might not be is because it might not just be routine to measure total energy sitting there in the system, right? That doesn't mean it couldn't be done, right? But I don't know if it is often done. Yeah, sure. And also, this isn't something that comes out of a measurement of the coherent signal. It's a measurement of the population. Of course, there'd be ways to extract it. Of course, right? Yeah.
Alex Pines has studied many of these multiple quantum coherences in NMR.
Oh, absolutely. No, of course. Multiple quantum coherences in NMR, that's well known, and it's coming from the dipolar coupling of the spin.
Right.
I think, in fact, I think Alex, maybe when Warren, when his was in his group, they went up to eight, right?
Yeah,
eight,
huge.
Eight quantum coherences. Sure.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Hundreds.
Hundreds. Hundreds of coherences. Okay.
Actually, if I could just inject another related to this.
Mm-hmm.
So are the densities here too low to think about the effects of interactions between?
Okay. So
and also, could you do this all in a trap?
Yes. Yeah. So very good question. So could you do it in an optical trap? The answer is I don't know if it's practical, but I've made some contacts with the folks at MIT who do this kind of work, and I don't know yet. But the point is we should be able to see two quantum coherences due to the dipolar interactions between polar molecules, right? Just like, in that case, it really is just like spins in NMR, right? You know, put a little context around some of those multiple quantum experiments in excitons and so forth. Really, of course, in NMR, it's a tool, right? You do it because you know exactly what the Hamiltonian is. You know that it's dipolar, magnetic dipole interaction, right? And then it's a great tool to make a spectrum a lot less sparse and do protein structure and everything else. Of course, in the case of multi-excitons, we don't know the Hamiltonian. That's the incentive to do it. It's ask, okay, no, it's not a tool for something else. I want to find out, in a basic sense, what's even correlated.
Okay, can you do it in the chlorosome of green sulfur bacteria?
Well, I think so. I think it's very likely because we already do it in those nanotubules.
Yep.
Those are kind of artificial chlorosomes.
Right, but they're more robust than chlorosome. I mean, if you could put the chlorosome in there and generate multiple excitons in hundreds of thousands chromophore systems.
I think it's very likely that we could do that. You know, we're not hitting these things all that hard.
Just wondered, what is the efficiency of the second harmonic generation in the spectrum?
my colleague is asking an embarrassing question. You know, what's the efficiency of the second harmonic generation? I don't actually know. Charlie may know. I don't. I would say it's probably about comparable to the efficiency that you routinely get at about the 30th or 50th harmonic, but it hasn't been optimized at all. So yeah. Oh well, to be honest, we haven't actually taken the second harmonic and spectrally resolved it. Right? Would be that's right. It should do that actually.
If collective emission depends also on the size and the shape of the sample, is it possible for you to actually model these parameters to see that dependence?
Yeah, well, so we haven't done it, but absolutely. So there are some things that I would love to do that we haven't really got underway yet. For example, put a cavity around the sample, right? Wouldn't be that hard. So yeah, of course, there are a bunch of things to follow up. You know, and this is why I think this is such a simple test bed for some of course, and get, of course, with a cavity, then we should be in the high field regime. Here we're in the perturbative regime, right? And I think there are just a bunch of interesting possibilities there. And so we haven't got that really underway, and I'm hoping we'll be able to do that soon. Yeah, yeah.
All right. So, one more question, please. Thank you.